legs and back broken. I gasped at the thought of Matthew's soft, human body plummeting to the hard stones. There was no way he could survive the fall, of course, Isabeau said softly. He was a dying man. Some of the masons said he'd slipped. Others said he was standing on the scaffolding one moment and gone the next. They thought Matthew had jumped, and were already talking about how he could not be buried in the church because he was a suicide. I could not let him die, fearing that he might not be saved from hell. He was so worried about being with Blanca and Lucas. How could he go to his death, wondering if he would be separated from them for all eternity? You did the right thing. It would have been impossible for me to walk away from him, no matter what the state of his soul. Leaving his body broken and hurting was unthinkable. If my blood would have saved him, I would have used it. Did I? Isabeau shook her head. I have never been sure. Philippe told me it was my decision whether to make Matthew one of our family. I had made other vampires with my blood, and I would make others after him. But Matthew was different. I was fond of him, and I knew that the gods were giving me a chance to make him my child. It would be my responsibility to teach him how a vampire must be in the world. Did Matthew resist you? I asked, unable to stop myself. No, she replied. He was out of his mind with pain. We told everyone to leave, saying we would fetch a priest. We didn't, of course. Philippe and I went to Matthew and explained we could make him live forever, without pain, without suffering. Much later, Matthew told us he thought we were Jean the Baptist and the Blessed Mother come to take him to heaven to be with his wife and child. When I offered him my blood, he thought I was the priest offering him last rites. The only sounds in the room were my quiet breathing and the crackle of logs in the fireplace. I wanted Isabeau to tell me the particulars of how she had made Matthew, but I was afraid to ask in case it was something that vampires didn't talk about. Perhaps it was too private or too painful. Isabeau soon told me without prompting. He took my blood so easily, like he was born to it, she said with a rustling sigh. Matthew was not one of those humans who turned their face from the scent or sight. I opened my wrist with my own teeth and told him my blood would heal him. He drank his salvation without fear. And afterward, I whispered. Afterward he was difficult, Isabeau said carefully. All new vampires are strong and full of anger, but Matthew was almost impossible to control. He was in a rage at being a vampire, and his need to feed was endless. Philippe and I had to hunt all day for weeks to satisfy him. And his body changed more than we expected. We all get taller, finer, stronger. I was much smaller before I became a vampire. But Matthew developed from a reed-thin human into a formidable creature. My husband was larger than my new son, but in the first flush of my blood, Matthew was a handful even for Philippe. I forced myself not to shrink from Matthew's hunger and rage. Instead, my eyes remained fixed on his mother, not closing my eyes for an instant against the knowledge of him. This was what Matthew feared, that I would come to understand who he had been, who he still was, and feel revulsion. What calmed him? I asked. Philippe took him hunting, Isabeau explained, once he thought that Matthew would no longer kill everything in his path. The hunt engaged his mind, and the chase engaged his body. He soon craved their hunt more than the blood, which is a good sign in young vampires. It meant he was no longer a creature of pure appetite, but was once again rational. After that, it was only a matter of time before his conscience returned, and he began to think before he killed. Then, all we had to fear were his black periods, when he felt the loss of Blanca and Lucas again and turned to humans to dull his anger. Did anything help Matthew then? Sometimes I sang to him, the same song I sang to you tonight, and others as well. That often broke the spell of his grief. Other times Matthew would go away. Philippe forbade me to follow or ask questions when he returned. Isabeau's eyes were black as she looked at me. Our glances confirmed what we both suspected, that Matthew had been lost with other women, seeking solace in their blood and the touch of hands that belonged to neither his mother nor his wife. "He's so controlled," I mused aloud. "It's hard to imagine him like that." "Matthew feels deeply. It is a blessing as well as a burden to love so much that you can hurt so badly when love is gone." There was a threat in Isabeau's voice. My chin went up in defiance, my fingers tingling. "Then I'll have to make sure my love never leaves him," I said tightly. "And how will you do that?" Isabeau taunted. "Would you become a vampire then and join us in our hunting?" She laughed, but there was neither joy nor mirth in the sound. "No doubt that's what Domenico suggested. One simple bite, the draining of your veins, the exchange of our blood for yours. The congregation would have no grounds to intrude on your business then." "What do you mean?" I asked numbly. "Don't you see?" Isabeau snarled. "If you must be with Matthew, then become one of us and put him and yourself out of danger. The witches may want to keep you as their own, but they cannot object to your relationship if you are vampire too." A low rumble started in Mart's throat. "Is that why Matthew went away? Did the congregation order him to make me a vampire?"
"Matthew would never make you, mon garçon,"
Mart said scornfully, her eyes snapping with fury. "No." Isabeau's voice was softly malicious. "He has always loved fragile things, as I told you." This was one of the secrets that Matthew was keeping. If I were a vampire, there would be no prohibitions looming over us, and thus no reason to fear the congregation. All I had to do was become something else. I contemplated the prospect with surprisingly little panic or fear. I could be with Matthew, and I might even be taller. Isabeau would do it. Her eyes glittered as she took in the way my hand moved to my neck. But there were my visions to consider, not to mention the power of the wind and the water. I didn't yet understand the magical potential in my blood, and as a vampire, I might never solve the mystery of Ashmole 782.
"I promised him," Mart said, her voice rough. "Diana must stay as she is, a witch."
Isabeau bared her teeth slightly, unpleasantly, and nodded. "Did you also promise not to tell me what really happened in Oxford?" Matthew's mother scrutinized me closely.
"You must ask Matthew when he returns. It is not my tale to tell."
I had other questions as well, questions that Matthew might have been too distracted to mark as off-limits. "Can you tell me why it matters that it was a creature who tried to break into the lab rather than a human?" There was a silence while Isabeau considered my words. Finally, she replied,
"Clever girl.
I did not promise Matthew to remain silent about appropriate rules of conduct, after all."
She looked at me with a touch of approval.
"Such behavior is not acceptable among creatures. We must hope it was a mischievous demon who does not realize the seriousness of what he has done. Matthew might forgive that."
"He has always forgiven demons," Mart muttered darkly.
"What if it wasn't a demon?"
"If it was a vampire, it represents a terrible insult. We are territorial creatures. A vampire does not cross into another vampire's house or land without permission."
Would Matthew forgive such an insult? Given the look on Matthew's face when he'd thrown a punch at the car, I suspected that the answer was no.
"Perhaps," Isabeau said doubtfully. "Nothing was taken, nothing was armed. But it is more likely Matthew would demand some form of retribution."
Once more, I'd been dropped into the Middle Ages, with the maintenance of honor and reputation the primary concern. "And if it was a witch?" I asked softly. Matthew's mother turned her face away.
"For a witch to do such a thing would be an act of aggression. No apology would be adequate."
Alarm bells sounded. I flung the covers aside and swung my legs out of bed. The break-in was meant to provoke Matthew. He went to Oxford thinking he could make a good-faith deal with Knox. We have to warn him. Isabeau's hands were firm on my knees and shoulder, stopping my motion.
He already knows, Diana.
That information settled in my mind. Is that why he wouldn't take me to Oxford with him? Is he in danger?
Of course he is in danger, Isabeau said sharply. But he will do what he can to put an end to this.
She lifted my legs back onto the bed and tucked the covers tightly around me.
I should be there, I protested. You would be nothing but a distraction. You will stay here, as he told you.
Don't I get a say in this? I asked, for what seemed like the 100th time since I came to set tour.
No, both women said at the same moment. You really do have a lot to learn about vampires, Isabeau said once again, but this time she sounded mildly regretful.
I had a lot to learn about vampires, this I knew. But who was going to teach me? And when?
Chapter 24 From afar, I beheld a black cloud covering the earth. It absorbed the earth and covered my soul as the seas entered, becoming putrid and corrupted at the prospect of hell and the shadow of death. A tempest had overwhelmed me, I read aloud from Matthew's copy of Aurora Consurgence. Turning to my computer, I typed notes about the imagery my anonymous author had used to describe Nigredo, one of the dangerous steps in alchemical transformation. During this part of the process, the combination of substances like mercury and lead gave off fumes that endangered the alchemist's health. Appropriately, one of Bourgo Lenoir's gargoyle-like faces pinched his nose tight shut, avoiding the cloud mentioned in the text.
Get your riding clothes on.
My head lifted from the pages of the manuscript.
Mathieu made me promise to take you outdoors. He said it would help you from getting sick, Isabeau explained.
You don't have to, Isabeau. Domenico and the Witchwater have depleted my adrenaline supply, if that's your concern.
Mathieu must have told you how alluring the smell of panic is to a vampire.
Marcus told me, I corrected her. Actually, he told me what it tastes like.
What does it smell like?
Isabeau shrugged.
Like it tastes. Maybe a bit more exotic. A touch of muskiness, perhaps. I was never much drawn to it. I prefer the kill to the hunt. But to each her own.
I'm not having as many panic attacks these days. There's no need for you to take me riding. I turned back to my work.
Why do you think they have gone away? Isabeau asked.
I honestly don't know, I said with a sigh, looking at Matthew's mother.
You have been like this for a long time?
Since I was 7.
What happened then?
My parents were killed in Nigeria, I replied shortly.
This was the picture you received, the one that caused Mathieu to bring you to cette tour.
When I nodded in response, Isabeau's mouth flattened into a familiar hard line.
Pigs.
There were worse things to call them, but pigs did the job pretty well. And if it grouped whoever had sent me the photograph with Domenico Michele, then it was the right category.
Panic or no panic, Isabeau said briskly, we are going to exercise as Mathieu wanted.
I powered off the computer and went upstairs to change. My riding clothes were folded neatly in the bathroom, courtesy of Mart, though my boots were in the stables, along with my helmet and vest. I slithered into the black breeches, added a turtleneck, and slipped on loafers over a pair of warm socks, then went downstairs in search of Matthew's mother.
"I'm in here,"
she called. I followed the sound to a small room painted warm terracotta. It was ornamented with old plates, animal horns, and an ancient dresser large enough to store an entire inn's worth of plates, cups, and cutlery. Isabeau peered over the pages of Le Monde, her eyes covering every inch of me.
Mart tells me you slept.
Yes, thank you. I shifted from one foot to the other as if waiting to see the school principal to explain my misbehavior.
Mart saved me from further discomfort by arriving with a pot of tea. She too surveyed me from head to foot.
"You are better today,"
she finally announced, handing me a mug. She stood there frowning until Matthew's mother put down her paper, and then she departed. When I was finished with my tea, we went to the stables. Isabeau had to help with my boots, since they were still too stiff to slide on and off easily, and she watched carefully while I put on my turtle shell of a vest and the helmet. Clearly, safety equipment had been part of Matthew's instructions. Isabeau, of course, wore nothing more protective than a brown quilted jacket. The relative indestructibility of vampire flesh was a boon if you were a rider. In the paddock, Fedat and Rakasa stood side by side, mirror images right down to the armchair-style saddles on their backs. "Isabeau," I protested, "George put the wrong tack on Rakasa. I don't ride side saddle."
"Are you afraid to try?"
Matthew's mother looked at me appraisingly. "No," I said, tamping down my temper. "I just prefer to ride astride."
"How do you know?"
Her emerald eyes flickered with a touch of malice. We stood for a few moments, staring at each other. Rakasa stamped her hoof and looked over her shoulder. "Are you going to ride or talk?" she seemed to be asking. "Behave," I replied brusquely, walking over and putting her fetlock against my knee.
"Georges has seen to this," Isabeau said in a bored tone.
"I don't ride horses I haven't checked myself." I examined Rakasa's hooves, ran my hands over her reins, and slid my fingers under the saddle.
"Philippe never did either."
Isabeau's voice held a note of grudging respect. With poorly concealed impatience, she watched me finish. When I was done, she led Fedat over to a set of steps and waited for me to follow. After she'd helped me get into the strange contraption of a saddle, she hopped onto her own horse. I took one look at her and knew I was in for quite a morning. Judging from her seat, Isabeau was a better rider than Matthew, and he was the best I'd ever seen.
"Walk around," Isabeau said. "I need to make sure you won't fall off and kill yourself."
"Show a little faith, Isabeau." "Don't let me fall," I bargained with Rakasa, "and I'll make sure you get an apple a day for the rest of your life." My mount's ears shot forward, then back, and she nickered gently. We circled the paddock twice before I drew to a gentle stop in front of Matthew's mother. "Satisfied?"
"You're a better rider than I expected," she admitted. "You could probably jump, but I promised Mathieu we would not."
"He managed to wheedle a fair number of promises out of you before he left," I muttered, hoping she wouldn't hear me.
"Indeed," she said crisply. "Some of them harder to keep than others."
We passed through the open paddock gate. George touched his cap to Isabeau and shut the gate behind us, grinning and shaking his head. Matthew's mother kept us on relatively flat ground while I got used to the strange saddle. The trick was to keep your body square, despite how off-kilter you felt.
"This isn't too bad," I said after about 20 minutes. "It is better now that the saddles have two pommels," Isabeau said. "Before, all side saddles were good for was being led around by a man."
Her disgust was audible.
"It was not until the Italian queen put a pommel and stirrup on her saddle that we could control our own horses. Her husband's mistress rode astride so she could go with him when he exercised. Catherine was always being left at home, which is most unpleasant for a wife."
She shot me a withering glance.
"Henri's hall was named after the goddess of the hunt, like you."
"I wouldn't have crossed Catherine de Medici," I shook my head.
"The king's mistress, Diane de Poitiers, was the dangerous one," Isabeau said darkly. "She was a witch."
"Actually or metaphorically?" I asked with interest. "Both," Matthew's mother said in a tone that could strip paint. I laughed. Isabeau looked surprised, then joined in. We rode a bit farther. Isabeau sniffed the air and sat taller in the saddle, her face alert. "What is it?" I asked anxiously, keeping Rakasa under a tight rein.
"Rabbit."
She kicked Fedat into a canter. I followed closely, reluctant to see if it was as difficult to track a witch in the forest as Matthew had suggested. We streaked through the trees and out into the open field. Isabeau held Fedat back, and I pulled alongside her.
"Have you seen a vampire kill?" Isabeau asked, watching my reaction carefully.
"No," I said calmly.
Rabbits are small. That's where we'll begin. Wait here.
She swung out of the saddle and dropped lightly to the ground. Fedot stood obediently, watching her mistress.
Diana, she said sharply, never taking her eyes off her prey, do not come near me while I'm hunting or feeding. Do you understand?
Yes. My mind raced at the implications. Isabeau was going to chase down a rabbit, kill it, and drink its blood in front of me. Staying far away seemed an excellent suggestion. Matthew's mother darted across the grassy field, moving so fast it was impossible to keep her in focus. She slowed just as a falcon does in midair before it swoops in for the kill, then bent and grabbed a frightened rabbit by the ears. Isabeau held it up triumphantly before sinking her teeth directly into its heart.
Rabbits may be small, but they're surprisingly bloody if you bite into them while they're still alive. It was horrifying.
Isabeau sucked the blood out of the animal, which quickly ceased struggling, then wiped her mouth clean on its fur and tossed the carcass into the grass. 3 seconds later, she was swinging herself back into the saddle. Her cheeks were slightly flushed, and her eyes sparkled more than usual. Once mounted, she looked at me.
Well, she asked, shall we look for something more feeling, or do you need to return to the house?
Isabeau de Clermont was testing me. After you, I said grimly, touching Rakasa's flank with my heel. The remainder of our ride was measured not by the movement of the sun, which was still hidden behind clouds, but by the increasing amounts of blood Isabeau's hungry mouth drew from her kills. She was a relatively neat eater. Still, it would be some time before I was happy at the prospect of a large steak. I was numb to the sight of blood after the rabbit, the enormous squirrel-like creature that Isabeau told me was a marmot, the fox, and the wild goat. Or so I thought. When Isabeau gave chase to a young doe, however, something prickled inside me.
Isabeau, I protested, you can't still be hungry, leave it.
What? The goddess of the ant objects to my pursuit of her deer?
Her voice mocked, but her eyes were curious.
Yes, I said promptly.
I object to your hunting of my son. See what good that has done.
Isabeau swung down from her horse. My fingers itched to intervene, and it was all I could do to stay out of Isabeau's way while she stalked her prey. After each kill, her eyes revealed that she wasn't completely in command of her emotions or her actions. The doe tried to escape. It almost succeeded by darting into some underbrush, but Isabeau frightened the animal back into the open. After that, fatigue put the doe at a disadvantage. The chase touched off something visceral within me. Isabeau killed swiftly, and the doe didn't suffer, but I had to bite my lip to keep from shouting.
There, she said with satisfaction, returning to Fedot. We can go back to Settur.
Wordlessly, I turned Rakasa's head in the direction of the chateau.
Isabeau grabbed my horse's reins. There were tiny drops of blood on her cream shirt. Do you think vampires are beautiful now? Do you still think it would be easy to live with my son, knowing that he must kill to survive?
It was difficult for me to put Matthew and killing in the same sentence. Were I to kiss him one day, when he was just returning from hunting, there might still be the taste of blood on his lips. And days like the one I was now spending with Isabeau would be regular occurrences.
If you're trying to frighten me away from your son, Isabeau.
You failed, I said resolutely. You're going to have to do better than this.
Mart said this would not be enough to make you reconsider, she confessed.
She was right. My voice was curt. Is the trial over? Can we go home now? We rode toward the trees in silence. Once we were within the forest's leafy green confines, Isabeau turned to me.
Do you understand why you must not question Mathieu when he tells you to do something?
I sighed. School is over for the day.
Do you think our dining habits are the only obstacle standing between you and my son?
Spit it out, Isabeau. Why must I do what Matthew says?
Because he is the strongest vampire in the chateau. He is the head of the house.
I stared at her in astonishment. Are you saying I have to listen to him because he's the alpha dog?
You think you are?
Isabeau chortled.
No, I conceded.
Isabeau wasn't the alpha dog either. She did what Matthew told her to do. So did Marcus, Miriam, and every vampire in the Bodleian Library. Even Domenico had ultimately backed down. Are these the de Clermont pack rules? Isabeau nodded, her green eyes glittering.
It is for your safety, and his, and everyone else's, that you must obey. This is not a game.
I understand, Isabeau. I was losing my patience.
No, you don't, she said softly. You won't, either, until you are forced to see, just as I made you see what it is for a vampire to kill. Until then, these are only words. One day your willfulness will cost your life, or someone else's. Then you will know why I told you this.
We returned to the chateau without further conversation. When we passed through Mart's ground floor domain, she came out of the kitchen, a small chicken in her hands. I blanched. Mart took in the tiny spots of blood on Isabeau's cuffs and gasped.
She needs to know, Isabeau hissed.
Mart said something low and foul-sounding in Occitan, then nodded at me.
Here, girl, come with me and I will teach you to make my tea.
Now it was Isabeau's turn to look furious. Mart made me something to drink and handed me a plate with a few crumbly biscuits studded with nuts. Eating chicken was out of the question. Mart kept me busy for hours, sorting dried herbs and spices into tiny piles and teaching me their names. By mid-afternoon, I could identify them by smell with my eyes closed, as well as by appearance. Parsley, ginger, feverfew, rosemary, sage, Queen Anne's lace seeds, mugwort, pennyroyal, angelica, rue, tansy, juniper root. I pointed to each in turn.
Again,
Mart said serenely, handing me a bunch of muslin bags. I picked the strings apart, laying them individually on the table just as she did, reciting the names back to her one more time.
Good. Now fill the bags with a pinch of each.
Why don't we just mix it all together and spoon it into the bags? I asked, taking a bit of pennyroyal between my fingers and wrinkling my nose at its minty smell.
We might miss something. Each bag must have every single herb, all 12.
Would missing a tiny seed like this really make a difference to the taste? I held a tiny Queen Anne's lace seed between my index finger and thumb.
One pinch of each, Mart repeated. Again.
The vampire's experienced hands moved surely from pile to pile, neatly filling the bags and tightening their strings. After we finished, Mart brewed me a cup of tea using a bag I'd filled myself. It's delicious, I said, happily sipping my very own herbal tea.
You will take it back to Oxford with you. One cup a day. It will keep you healthy.
She started putting bags into a tin. When you need more, you will know how to make it. Mart, you don't have to give me all of it, I protested.
You will drink this for Mart. One cup a day, yes?
Of course. It seemed the least I could do for my sole remaining ally in the house, not to mention the person who fed me. After my tea, I went upstairs to Matthew's study and switched on my computer. All that writing had made my forearms ache, so I moved the computer and the manuscript to his desk, hoping that it might be more comfortable to work there rather than at my table by the window. Unfortunately, the leather chair was made for someone Matthew's height, not mine, and my feet swung freely. Sitting in Matthew's chair made him seem closer, however, so I remained there while waiting for my computer to boot up. My eyes fell on a dark object tucked into the tallest shelf. It blended into the wood and the book's leather bindings, which hid it from casual view. From Matthew's desk, however, you could see its outlines. It wasn't a book, but an ancient block of wood, octagonal in shape. Tiny arched windows were carved into each side. The thing was black, cracked, and misshapen with age. With a pang of sadness, I realized it was a child's toy. Matthew had made it for Lucas before Matthew became a vampire, while he was building the first church. He'd tucked it into the corner of a shelf where no one would notice it, except him. He couldn't fail to see it every time he sat at his desk. With Matthew at my side, it was all too easy to think we were the only two in the world. Not even Domenico's warnings or Isabeau's tests had shaken my sense that our growing closeness was a matter solely between him and me. But this little wooden tower, made with love an unimaginably long time ago, brought my illusions to an end. There were children to consider, both living and dead. There were families involved, including my own, with long and complicated genealogies and deeply ingrained prejudices, including my own. And Sarah and Em still didn't know that I was in love with a vampire. It was time to share that news. Isabeau was in the salon, arranging flowers in a tall vase on top of a priceless Louis XIV escritoire with impeccable provenance and a single owner. "Isabeau?" My voice sounded hesitant. "Is there a phone I could use?"
"He will call you when he wants to talk to you."
She took great care placing a twig with turning leaves still attached to it among the white and golden flowers. "I'm not calling Matthew, Isabeau. I need to speak with my aunt."
"The witch who called the other night?" she asked. "What is her name?"
"Sarah," I said with a frown.
"And she lives with a woman, another witch, yes?"
Isabeau kept putting white roses into the vase. "Yes, Emily. Is that a problem?"
"No,"
Isabeau said, eyeing me over the blooms.
"They are both witches. That's all that matters."
"That and they love each other."
"Sarah is a good name,"
Isabeau continued, as if I hadn't spoken. "You know the legend, of course." I shook my head. Isabeau's changes in conversation were almost as dizzying as her son's mood swings.
"The mother of Isaac was called Sarai.
Quarrelsome. But when she became pregnant, God changed it to Sarah, which means princess." "In my aunt's case, Sarai is much more appropriate." I waited for Isabeau to tell me where the phone was.
"Emily is also a good name, a strong Roman name."
Isabeau clipped a rose stem between her sharp fingernails. "What does Emily mean, Isabeau?" Happily, I was running out of family members.
"It means industrious. Of course, the most interesting name belonged to your mother. Rebecca means captivated or bound," Isabeau said, a frown of concentration on her face as she studied the vase from one side and then the other. "An interesting name for a witch."
"And what does your name mean?" I said impatiently.
"I was not always Isabeau, but it was the name Philippe liked for me. It means God's promise."
Isabeau hesitated, searching my face, and made a decision.
"My full name is Genevieve Melisande Hélène Isabeau Aude de Clermont."
"It's beautiful." My patience returned as I speculated about the history behind the names. Isabeau gave me a small smile.
"Names are important."
"Does Matthew have other names?" I took a white rose from the basket and handed it to her. She murmured her thanks.
"Of course. We give all of our children many names when they are reborn to us. But Mathieu was the name he came to us with, and he wanted to keep it. Christianity was very new then, and Philippe thought it might be useful if our son was named after an evangelist."
"What are his other names?"
"His full name is Mathieu Gabriel Philippe Bertrand Sébastien de Clermont."
"He was also a very good Sébastien, and a passable Gabriel. He hates Bertrand, and will not answer to Philippe." "What is it about Philippe that bothers him?"
"It was his father's favorite name."
Isabeau's hands stilled for a moment.
"You must know he is dead. The Nazis caught him fighting for the resistance."
In the vision I'd had of Isabeau, she'd said Matthew's father was captured by witches.
"Nazis, Isabeau, or witches?"
I asked quietly, fearing the worst.
"Did Mathieu tell you?"
Isabeau looked shocked.
"No.
I saw you in one of my visions yesterday. You were crying."
"Witches and Nazis both killed Philippe," she said after a long pause. "The pain is recent and sharp, but it will fade in time. For years after he was gone, I hunted only in Argentina and Germany. It kept me sane."
"Isabeau, I'm so sorry." The words were inadequate, but they were heartfelt. Matthew's mother must have heard my sincerity, and she gave me a hesitant smile.
"It is not your fault. You are not there."
"What names would you give me if you had to choose?" I asked softly, handing another stem to Isabeau.
"Mathieu is right. You are only Diana," she said, pronouncing it in the French style as she always did, with the emphasis on the first syllable. "There are no other names for you. It is who you are."
Isabeau pointed her white finger at the door to the library.
"The phone is inside."
Seated at the desk in the library, I switched on the lamp and dialed New York, hoping that both Sarah and Em were home. "Diana," Sarah sounded relieved. Em said it was you. I'm sorry I couldn't call back last night. A lot happened. I picked up a pencil and began to twirl it through my fingers. Would you like to talk about it? Sarah asked. I almost dropped the phone. My aunt demanded we talk about things she never requested. Is Em there? I'd rather tell the story once. Em picked up the extension, her voice warm and comforting. Hi, Diana. Where are you?
With Matthew's mother near Lyon.
Matthew's mother? Em was curious about genealogy, not just her own, which was long and complicated, but everyone else's, too.
Isabeau de Clermont.
I did my best to pronounce it as Isabeau did, with its long vowels and swallowed consonants. She's something, Em. Sometimes I think she's the reason humans are so afraid of vampires. Isabeau's straight out of a fairy tale.
There was a pause. Do you mean you're with Mélisande de Clermont?
Em's voice was intense.
I didn't even think of the de Clermonts when you told me about Matthew. You're sure her name is Isabeau?
I frowned. Actually, her name is Genevieve. I think there's a Mélisande in there, too. She just prefers Isabeau.
Be careful, Diana, Em warned. Mélisande de Clermont is notorious. She hates witches, and she ate her way through most of Berlin after World War II.
She has a good reason to hate witches, I said, rubbing my temples. I'm surprised she let me into her house. If the situation was reversed and vampires were involved in my parents' death, I wouldn't be so forgiving.
What about the water? Sarah interjected. I'm more worried about the vision Em had of a tempest.
Oh, I started raining last night after Matthew left.
The soggy memory made me shiver.
Which water?
Sarah breathed, now understanding.
What brought it on?
I don't know, Sarah. I felt empty. When Matthew pulled out of the driveway, the tears I'd been fighting since Domenico showed up all just poured out of me.
Domenico who?
Emily flipped through her mental roster of legendary creatures again.
Michele?
A Venetian vampire. My voice filled with anger. And if he bothers me again, I'm gonna rip his head off, vampire or not.
He's dangerous, Em cried. That creature doesn't play by the rules.
I've been told that many times over, and you can rest easy knowing I'm under guard 24 hours a day. Don't worry.
We'll worry until you're no longer hanging around with vampires, Sarah observed.
You'll be worrying for a good long time then, I said stubbornly. I love Matthew, Sarah.
That's impossible, Diana. Vampires and witches, Sarah began.
Domenico told me about the covenant, I interjected. I'm not asking anyone else to break it, and I understand that this might mean you can't or won't have anything to do with me. For me, there's no choice.
But the congregation will do what they must to end this relationship, Em said urgently.
I've been told that, too. They'll have to kill me to do it.
Until this moment, I hadn't said the words out loud, but I'd been thinking them since last night.
Matthew's harder to get rid of, but I'm a pretty easy target.
You can't just walk into danger that way.
Em was fighting back tears.
Her mother did, Sarah said quietly.
What about my mother?
My voice broke at the mention of her, along with my composure.
Rebecca walked straight into Stephen's arms, even after people said it was a bad idea for two witches with their talents to be together. And she refused to listen when people told her to stay out of Nigeria.
All the more reason that Diana should listen now, Em said. You've only known him for a few weeks. Come back home and see if you can forget about him.
Forget about him?
It was ridiculous.
This isn't a crush. I've never felt this way about anyone.
Leave her alone, Em. We've had enough of that kind of talk in this family. I didn't forget about you, and she's not going to forget about him.
Sarah let out her breath with a sigh that carried all the way to the Auvergne.
This may not be the life I would have chosen for you, but we all have to decide for ourselves. Your mother did. I did. And your grandmother didn't have an easy time with it, by the way. Now it's your turn. But no bishop ever turns her back on another bishop.
Tears stung in my eyes.
Thank you, Sarah.
Besides, Sarah continued, working herself into a state, if the congregation is made up of things like Domenico Michele, then they can all go to hell.
What does Matthew say about this? Em asked.
I'm surprised he would leave you once you two had decided to break with 1,000 years of tradition. Matthew hasn't told me how he feels yet.
I methodically unbent a paperclip. There was dead silence on the line. Finally, Sarah spoke.
What is he waiting for?
I laughed out loud.
You've done nothing but warn me to stay away from Matthew. Now you're upset because he refuses to put me in greater danger than I'm already in? You want to be with him. That should be enough. This isn't some kind of magical arranged marriage, Sarah. I get to make my decision, so does he.
The tiny clock with the porcelain face that was sitting on the desk indicated it had been 24 hours since he left.
If you're determined to stay there with those creatures, then be careful, Sarah warned as we said goodbye. And if you need to come home, come home.
After I hung up, the clock struck the half hour. It was already dark in Oxford. To hell with waiting. I lifted the receiver again and dialed his number.
Diana?
He was clearly anxious.
I laughed. Did you know it was me, or was it caller ID?
You're all right. The anxiety was replaced with relief.
Yes, your mother is keeping me vastly entertained.
I was afraid of that. What lies has she been telling you?
The more trying parts of the day could wait. Only the truth, I said, that her son is some diabolical combination of Lancelot and Superman.
That sounds like Isabeau, he said with a hint of laughter. What a relief to know that she hasn't been irreversibly changed by sleeping under the same roof as a witch.
Distance, no doubt, helped me evade him with my half-truths. Distance couldn't diminish my vivid picture of him sitting in his Morris chair at All Souls, however. The room would be glowing from the lamps, and his skin would look like polished pearl. I imagined him reading, the deep crease of concentration between his brows.
What are you drinking?
It was the only detail my imagination couldn't supply.
Since when have you cared about wine?
He sounded genuinely surprised.
Since I found out how much there was to know.
Since I found out that you cared about wine, you idiot.
Something Spanish tonight. Vega Cecilia.
From when?
Do you mean which vintage? Matthew teased. It's 1964.
A relative baby, then? I teased back, relieved at the change in his mood.
An infant, he agreed. I didn't need a sixth sense to know that he was smiling.
How did everything go today?
Fine. We've increased our security, though nothing was missing. Someone tried to hack into the computers, but Miriam assures me there's no way anyone could break into her system.
Are you coming back soon?
The words escaped before I could stop them, and the ensuing silence stretched longer than was comfortable. I told myself it was the connection. I don't know, he said coolly. I'll be back when I can.
Do you want to talk to your mother? I could find her for you.
His sudden aloofness hurt, and it was a struggle to keep my voice even.
No, you can tell her the labs are fine. The house, too.
We said goodbye. My chest was tight, and it was difficult to inhale. When I managed to stand and turn around, Matthew's mother was waiting in the doorway.
That was Matthew.
Nothing at the lab or the house was damaged. I'm tired, Isabeau, and not very hungry. I think I'll go to bed. It was nearly 8. A perfectly respectable time to turn in.
Of course.
Isabeau stepped out of my way with glittering eyes.
Sleep well, Diana.
Chapter 25. Mart had been up to Matthew's study while I was on the phone, and sandwiches, tea, and water were waiting for me. She'd loaded the fireplace with logs to burn through the night, and a handful of candles shed their golden glow. The same inviting light and warmth upstairs would be in the bedroom, too. But my mind wouldn't shut off, and trying to sleep would be futile. The Aurora manuscript was waiting for me on Matthew's desk. Sitting down at my computer, I avoided the sight of his winking armor and switched on his space-age minimalist desk light to read. I spoke aloud. Give me knowledge of my end and the measure of my days so I may know my frailty. My lifetime is no longer than the width of my hand. It is only a moment compared to yours. The passage only made me think of Matthew. Trying to concentrate on alchemy was pointless, so I decided to make a list of queries regarding what I'd already read. All that was needed was a pen and a piece of paper.
Matthew's massive mahogany desk was as dark and solid as its owner, and it exuded the same gravitas. It had drawers extending down both sides of the space left for his knees, the drawers resting on round, bun-shaped feet. Just below the writing surface, running all around the perimeter, was a thick band of carving. Acanthus leaves, tulips, scrolls, and geometrical shapes invited you to trace their outlines. Unlike the surface of my desk, which was always piled so high with papers, books, and half-drunk cups of tea that you risked disaster whenever you tried to work on it, this desk held only an Edwardian desk pad, a sword-shaped letter opener, and the lamp. Like Matthew, it was a bizarrely harmonious blend of ancient and modern. There were, however, no office supplies in sight. I grasped the round brass pull on the top right-hand drawer. Inside, everything was neat and precisely arranged. The Mont Blanc pens were segregated from the Mont Blanc pencils, and the paper clips were arranged by size. After selecting a pen and putting it on the desk, I attempted to open the remaining drawers. They were locked. The key wasn't underneath the paper clips. I dumped them on the desk just to be sure. An unmarked sheet of pale green blotting paper stretched between the desk pad's leather bumpers. In lieu of a legal pad, that would have to do. Picking up my computer to clear the desk, I knocked the pen to the floor. It had fallen under the drawers and was just out of reach. I crawled into the desk's knee hole to retrieve it. Worming my hand under the drawers, my fingers found the thick barrel just as my eyes spotted the outline of a drawer in the dark wood above. Frowning, I wriggled out from under the desk. There was nothing in the deep carving circling the desktop that released the catch on the concealed drawer. Leave it to Matthew to stash basic supplies in a drawer that was difficult to open. It would serve him right if every inch of his blotter was covered with graffiti when he returned home. I wrote the number 1 in thick black ink on the green paper. Then I froze. A desk drawer that was difficult to find was designed to hide something. Matthew kept secrets, this I knew, but we had known each other only a few weeks, and even the closest of lovers deserved privacy. Still, Matthew's tight-lipped manner was infuriating, and his secrets surrounded him like a fortress devised to keep other people, me, out. Besides, I only needed a piece of paper. Hadn't he rifled through my belongings at the Bodleian when he was looking for Ashmole 782? We'd barely met when he pulled that stunt. And he had left me to shift for myself in France. As I carefully recapped the pen, my conscience nevertheless prickled. But my sense of injury helped me to cast that warning aside. Pushing and pulling at every bump and bulge, my fingers searched the carvings on the desk's front edge once more without success. Matthew's letter opener rested invitingly near my right hand. It might be possible to wedge it into the seam underneath and pry the drawer open. Given the age of the desk, the historian in me squawked, much louder than my conscience had. Violating Matthew's privacy and engaging in ethically questionable behavior might be permissible, but I wasn't going to deface an antique. Under the desk once more, I found it was too dark to see the underside of the drawer clearly, but my fingers located something cold and hard embedded in the wood. To the left of the drawer's nearly imperceptible join was a small metal bump, approximately one long vampire reach from the front of the desk. It was round and had cross-hatching in the center, to make it look like a screw or an old nail head. There was a soft click overhead when I pushed it. Standing, I stared into a tray about 4 inches deep. It was lined with black velvet, and there were 3 depressions in the thick padding. Each held a bronze coin or medal. The largest one had a building's outline cut into its surface and rested in the middle of a hollow nearly 4 inches across. The image was surprisingly detailed and showed 4 steps leading up to a door flanked by 2 columns. Between them was a shrouded figure. The building's crisp outlines were marred by fragments of black wax. Around the edge of the coin were the words, "Militiae Lazari a Bethania," the Knights of Lazarus of Bethany. Gripping the tray's edges to steady myself, I abruptly sat down. The metal discs weren't coins or medals, they were seals, the kind used to close official correspondence and certify property transactions. A wax impression attached to an ordinary piece of paper could once have commanded armies to leave the field, or auctioned off great estates.
Based on the residue, at least one seal had been used recently. Fingers shaking, I pried one of the smaller discs from the tray. Its surface bore a copy of the same building. The columns and the shrouded figure of Lazarus, the man from Bethany whom Christ raised from the dead after he'd been entombed for 4 days, were unmistakable. Here, Lazarus was depicted stepping out of a shallow coffin. But no words encircled this seal. Instead, the building was surrounded by a snake, its tail in its mouth. I couldn't close my eyes quickly enough to banish the sight of the de Clermont family standard and its silver Ouroboros snapping in the breeze above Cette Tour. The seal lay in my palm, its bronze surfaces gleaming. I focused on the shiny metal, willing my new visionary power to shed light on the mystery, but I'd spent more than 2 decades ignoring the magic in my blood, and it felt no compunction to come to my aid now. Without a vision, my mundane historical skills would have to be put to work. I examined the back of the small seal closely, taking in its details. A cross with flared edges divided the seal into quarters, similar to the one Matthew had worn on his tunic in my vision. In the upper right quadrant of the seal was a crescent moon, its horns curved upward in a 6-pointed star nestled in its belly. In the lower left quadrant was a fleur-de-lis, the traditional symbol of France. Inscribed around the edge of the seal was the date MDCI, 1601 in Roman numerals, along with the words Secretum Lazari, the secret of Lazarus. It couldn't be a coincidence that Lazarus, like a vampire, had made the journey from life to death and back again. Moreover, the cross, combined with a legendary figure from the Holy Land and the mention of knights, strongly suggested that the seals in Matthew's desk drawer belonged to one of the orders of Crusader knights established in the Middle Ages. The best known were the Templars, who had mysteriously disappeared in the early 14th century after being accused of heresy and worse. But I'd never heard of the Knights of Lazarus. Turning the seal this way and that to catch the light, I focused on the date, 1601. It was late for a medieval chivalric order. I searched my memory for important events of that year that might shed light on the mystery. Queen Elizabeth I beheaded the Earl of Essex, and the Danish astronomer Tycho Brahe died under far less colorful circumstances. Neither of these events seemed remotely relevant. My fingers moved lightly over the carving. The meaning of MDCI washed over me. Matthew de Clermont. These were letters, not Roman numerals. It was an abbreviation of Matthew's name, MDCL. I was misreading the final letter. The 2-inch disc sat in my palm, and my fingers closed firmly around it, pressing the incised surface deep into the skin. This smaller disc must have been Matthew's private seal. The power of such seals was so great that they were usually destroyed when someone died or left office, so that no one else could use them to commit fraud. And only one knight would have both the great seal and a personal seal in his possession, the order's leader. Why Matthew kept the seals hidden puzzled me. Who cared about or even remembered the Knights of Lazarus, never mind his one-time role in the order? My attention was captured by the black wax on the great seal. "It's not possible," I whispered numbly, shaking my head. "Knights in shining armor belong to the past. They weren't active today." The Matthew-sized suit of armor gleamed in the candlelight. I dropped the metal disc into the drawer with a clatter. The flesh of my palm had poured into the impressions and now carried its image right down to its flared cross, crescent moon and star, and fleur-de-lis. The reason Matthew had the seals, and the reason fresh wax clung to one of them, was that they were still in use. The Knights of Lazarus were still in existence.
"Diana, are you all right?"
Isabeau's voice echoed up from the foot of the stairs.
"Yes, Isabeau,"
I called, staring at the seal's image on my hand. "I'm reading my email and got some unexpected news, that's all."
"Shall I send Mart up for the tray?"
"No," I blurted. "I'm still eating." Her footsteps receded toward the salon. When there was complete silence, I let out my breath. Moving as quickly and quietly as possible, I flipped the other seal over in its velvet-lined niche. It was nearly identical to Matthew's, except that the upper right quadrant held only the crescent moon, and Philippus was inscribed around the border. This seal had belonged to Matthew's father, which meant that the Knights of Lazarus were a de Clermont family affair. Certain that there would be no more clues about the order and the desk, I turned the seal so that Lazarus's tomb was facing me once more. The drawer made a hushed click as it slid invisibly into position underneath the desk. I picked up the table that Matthew used to hold his afternoon wine and carried it over to the bookcases. He wouldn't mind me looking through his library, or so I told myself, kicking off my loafers. The table's burnished surface gave a warning creak when I swung my feet onto it and stood, but the wood held fast. The wooden toy at the far right of the top shelf was at eye level now. I sucked in a deep breath and pulled out the first item from the opposite end. It was ancient. The oldest manuscript I'd ever handled. The leather cover complained when it opened, and the smell of old sheepskin rose from the pages. Carmina qui quandam studio florente perigi. Flabilis heiu maestos cogor inire modos, read the first lines. My eyes pricked with tears. It was Boethius's 6th-century work, The Consolation of Philosophy, written in prison while he was awaiting death. To pleasant songs my work was once given, and bright were all my labors then. But now in tears to sad refrains I must return. I imagined Matthew, bereft of Blanca and Lucas and bewildered by his new identity as a vampire, reading words written by a condemned man, giving silent thanks to whoever had offered him this in hope of lessening his grief, I slid the book back into place. The next volume was a beautifully illustrated manuscript of Genesis, the biblical story of creation. Its strong blues and reds looked as fresh as the day they had been painted. Another illustrated manuscript, this one a copy of Dioscorides' Book of Plants, was also on the top shelf, along with more than a dozen other biblical books, several law books, and a book in Greek. The shelf below held more of the same. Books of the Bible, mostly, along with a medical book and a very early copy of a 7th-century encyclopedia. It represented Isidore of Seville's attempt to capture all of human knowledge, and it would have appealed to Matthew's endless curiosity. At the bottom of the first folio was the name Matthieu, along with the phrase Meus Liber, my book. Feeling the same urge to trace the letters as when I faced Ashmole 782 in the Bodleian, my fingers faltered on their way to the surface of the vellum. Then I'd been too afraid of the reading room supervisors and my own magic to risk it. Now it was fear of learning something unexpected about Matthew that held me back. But there was no supervisor here, and my fears became insignificant when weighed against my desire to understand the vampire's past. I traced Matthew's name. An image of him sharp and clear came to me without the use of stern commands or shining surfaces. He was seated at a plain table by a window, looking just as he did now, biting his lip with concentration as he practiced his writing. Matthew's long fingers gripped a reed pen, and he was surrounded by sheets of vellum, all of which bore repeated blotchy attempts to write his own name and copy out biblical passages. Following Mart's advice, I didn't fight the visions of arrival or departure, and the experience wasn't as disorienting as it had been last night. Once my fingers had revealed all they could, I replaced the encyclopedia and continued to work my way through the remaining volumes in the case. There were history books, more law books, books on medicine and optics, Greek philosophy, books of accounts, the collected works of early church notables like Bernard of Clairvaux, and chivalric romances, one involving a knight who changed into a wolf once a week. But none revealed fresh information about the Knights of Lazarus. I bit back a sound of frustration and climbed down from the table. My knowledge of crusade orders was sketchy. Most of them started out as military units that were renowned for bravery and discipline. The Templars were famous for being the first to enter the field of battle and the last to leave. But the Order's military efforts were not limited to the area around Jerusalem. The knights fought in Europe, too, and many answered only to the Pope rather than to kings or other secular authorities. Nor was the power of the chivalric orders solely military. They'd built churches, schools, and leper hospitals. The military orders safeguarded crusader interests, whether spiritual, financial, or physical.
Vampires like Matthew were territorial and possessive to the last, and therefore ideally suited to the role of guardians. But the power of the military orders led ultimately to their downfall. Monarchs and popes were jealous of their wealth and influence. In 1312, the Pope and the French king saw to it that the Templars were disbanded, ridding themselves of the threat posed by the largest, most prestigious brotherhood. Most of the other orders gradually petered out due to lack of support and interest. There were all those conspiracy theories, of course. A vast, complex international institution is hard to dismantle overnight, and the sudden dissolution of the Knights Templar had led to all sorts of fantastic tales about rogue crusaders and underground operations. People still searched for traces of the Templars' fabulous wealth. The fact that no one had ever found evidence of how it was dispersed only added to the intrigue. The money. It was one of the first lessons historians learned. Follow the money. I refocused my search. The sturdy outlines of the first ledger were visible on the third shelf, tucked between Al-Hazan's optics and a romantic French chanson de geste. A small Greek letter was inked on the manuscript's foredge. Alpha. Figuring it must be an indexing mark of some sort, I scanned the shelves and located the second account book. It, too, had a small Greek letter, Beta. My eyes lit on Gamma, Delta, and Epsilon scattered among the shelves, too. A more careful search would locate the rest, I was sure. Feeling like Elliot Ness waving a fistful of tax receipts in pursuit of Al Capone, I held up my hand. There was no time to waste on climbing to retrieve it. The first account book slid from its resting place and fell into my waiting palm. Its entries were dated 1117 and were made by a number of different hands. Names and numbers danced across the pages. My fingers were busy, taking in all the information they could from the writing. A few faces bloomed out of the vellum repeatedly. Matthew, the dark man with the hawkish nose, a man with bright hair the color of burnished copper, another with warm brown eyes and a serious face. My hands stilled over an entry for money received in 1149, Eleanor Regina, 40,000 marks. It was a staggering sum. More than half the yearly income of the Kingdom of England. Why was the Queen of England giving so much money to a military order led by vampires? But the Middle Ages were too far outside my expertise for me to be able to answer that question, or to know much about the people engaging in the transfers. I shut the book with a snap and went to the 16th and 17th century bookcases. Nestled among the other books was a volume bearing the identifying mark of a Greek lambda. My eyes widened once it was open. Based on this ledger, the Knights of Lazarus had paid, somewhat unbelievably, for a wide range of wars, goods, services, and diplomatic feats, including providing Mary Tudor's dowry when she married Philippe of Spain, buying the cannon for the Battle of Lepanto, bribing the French so they'd attend the Council of Trent, and financing most of the military actions of the Lutheran Schmalkaldic League. Apparently, the Brotherhood didn't allow politics or religion to get in the way of their investment decisions. In a single year, they'd bankrolled Mary Stuart's return to the Scottish throne and paid off Elizabeth I's sizable debts to the Antwerp Bourse. I walked along the shelves looking for more books marked with Greek letters. On the 19th century shelves, there was one with the forked letter Psi on its faded blue buckram spine. Inside, vast sums of money were meticulously accounted for, along with property sales that made my head spin. How did one secretly purchase most of the factories in Manchester? And familiar names belonging to royalty, aristocrats, presidents, and Civil War generals. There were also smaller payouts for school fees, clothing allowances, and books, along with entries concerning dowries paid, hospital bills settled, and past due rents brought up to date. Next to all the unfamiliar names was the abbreviation MLB or FMLB. My Latin was not as good as it should be, but I was sure the abbreviation stood for the Knights of Lazarus of Bethany, Militiae Lazari of Bethania, or for Filia Militiae or Filius Militiae, the daughters and sons of the Knights. And if the orders were still disbursing funds in the middle of the 19th century, the same was probably true today. Somewhere in the world, a piece of paper, A real estate transaction, a legal agreement, bore an impression of the order's great seal in thick, black wax. And Matthew had applied it. Hours later, I was back in the medieval section of Matthew's library and opened my last account book. This volume spanned the period from the late 13th century to the first half of the 14th century. The staggering sums were now expected, but around 1310 the number of entries increased dramatically, so too did the flow of money. A new annotation accompanied some of the names, a tiny red cross. In 1313, next to one of these marks, was a name I recognized, Jacques de Molay, the last Grand Master of the Knights Templar. He'd been burned at the stake for heresy in 1314. A year before he was executed, he'd turned over everything he owned to the Knights of Lazarus. There were hundreds of names marked with red crosses. Were they all Templars? If so, then the mystery of the Templars was solved. The Knights and their money hadn't disappeared. Both had simply been absorbed into the Order of Lazarus. It couldn't be true. Such a thing would have taken too much planning and coordination, and no one could have kept such a grand scheme secret. The idea was as implausible as stories about witches and vampires. The Knights of Lazarus was no more or less believable than I was. As for conspiracy theories, their chief weakness was that they were so complex. No lifetime was sufficient to gather the necessary information, build the links between all the required elements, and then set the plans in motion. Unless, of course, the conspirators were vampires. If you were a vampire, or better yet, a family of vampires, then the passage of time would matter little. As I knew from Matthew's scholarly career, vampires had all the time they needed. The enormity of what it meant to love a vampire struck home as I slid the account book back onto the shelf. It was not just his age that posed the difficulties, or his dining habits, or the fact that he had killed humans and would do so again. It was the secrets. Matthew had been accumulating secrets, large ones like the Knights of Lazarus and his son Lucas, small ones like his relationship with William Harvey and Charles Darwin, for well over a millennium. My life might be too brief to hear them all, never mind understand them. But it was not only vampires who kept secrets. All creatures learned to do so out of fear of discovery and to preserve something, anything, just for ourselves within our clannish, almost tribal world. Matthew was not simply a hunter, a killer, a scientist, or a vampire, but a web of secrets, just as I was. For us to be together, we needed to decide which secrets to share and then let the others go. The computer chimed in the quiet room when my fingers pressed the power button. Mart's sandwiches were dry and the tea was cold, but I nibbled so that she wouldn't think her efforts had gone unappreciated. Finished, I sat back and stared into the fire. The Knights of Lazarus roused me as a historian, and my witch's instincts told me the Brotherhood was important to understanding Matthew. But their existence was not his most important secret. Matthew was guarding himself, his innermost nature. What a complicated, delicate business it was going to be to love him. We were the stuff of fairy tales, vampires, witches, knights in shining armor. But there was a troubling reality to face. I had been threatened, and creatures watched me in the Bodleian in hopes I'd recall a book that everyone wanted but no one understood. Matthew's laboratory had been targeted, and our relationship was destabilizing the fragile detente that had long existed among demons, humans, vampires, and witches. This was a new world, in which creatures were pitted against creatures, and a silent, secret army could be called into action by a stamp in a pool of black wax. It was no wonder that Matthew might prefer to put me aside. I snuffed the candles and climbed the stairs to bed. Exhausted, I quickly drifted off, my dreams filled with knights, bronze seals, and endless books of accounts. A cold, slender hand touched my shoulder, waking me instantly. Matthew? I sat bolt upright. Isabeau's white face glimmered in the darkness. It's for you? She handed me her red mobile and left the room. Sarah? I was terrified that something had happened to my aunts.
It's all right, Diana.
Matthew. What's happened? My voice shook. Did you make a deal with Nox?
No. I can't make any progress there. There's nothing left for me in Oxford. I want to be home, with you. I should be there in a few hours.
He sounded strange, his voice thick. Am I dreaming?
You're not dreaming, Matthew said. And Diana?
He hesitated.
I love you.
It was what I most wanted to hear. The forgotten chain inside me started to sing, quietly, in the dark. Come here and tell me that, I said softly, my eyes filling with tears of relief.
You haven't changed your mind?
Never, I said fiercely.
You'll be in danger and your family, too. Are you willing to risk that for my sake?
I made my choice. We said goodbye and hung up reluctantly, afraid of the silence that would follow after so much had been said. While he was gone, I had stood at a crossroads, unable to see a way forward. My mother had been known for her uncanny visionary abilities. Would she have been powerful enough to see what awaited us as we took our first steps? Together? Chapter 26. I'd been waiting for the crunch of tires on gravel since pushing the disconnect button on Isabeau's tiny mobile phone, and since then, it hadn't been out of my sight. A fresh pot of tea and breakfast rolls were waiting for me when I emerged from the bathroom, phone in hand. I bolted the food, flung on the first clothes that my fingers touched, and flew down the stairs with wet hair. Matthew wouldn't reach set tour for hours, but I was determined to be waiting when he pulled up. First, I waited in the salon on a sofa by the fire, wondering what had happened in Oxford to make Matthew change his mind. Mart brought me a towel and roughly dried my hair with it when I showed no inclination to use it myself. As the time of his arrival grew nearer, pacing in the hall was preferable to sitting in the salon. Isabeau appeared and stood with her hands on her hips. I continued, despite her forbidding presence, until Mart brought a wooden chair to the front door. She convinced me to sit, though the chair's carving had clearly been designed to acquaint its occupants with the discomforts of hell, and Matthew's mother retreated to the library. When the Range Rover entered the courtyard, I flew outside. For the first time in our relationship, Matthew didn't beat me to the door. He was still straightening his long legs when my arms locked around his neck, my toes barely touching the ground. "Don't do that again," I whispered, my eyes shut against sudden tears. "Don't ever do that again." Matthew's arms went around me, and he buried his face in my neck. We held each other without speaking. Matthew reached up and loosened my grip, gently setting me back on my feet. He cupped my face, and familiar touches of snow and frost melted on my skin. I committed new details of his features to memory, such as the tiny creases at the corners of his eyes and the precise curve of the hollow under his full lower lip. "Dieu," he whispered in wonder. "I was wrong."
"Wrong?" My voice was panicky. "I thought I knew how much I missed you, but I had no idea."
"Tell me." I wanted to hear again the words he'd said on the phone last night.
"I love you, Diana. God help me, I tried not to." My face softened into his hands.
"I love you too, Matthew, with all my heart." Something in his body altered subtly at my response. It wasn't his pulse, since he didn't have much of a pulse, nor his skin, which remained deliciously cool. Instead, there was a sound, a catch in his throat, a murmur of longing that sent a shock of desire through me. Matthew detected it, and his face grew fierce. He bent his head, fitting his cold lips to mine. The resulting changes in my body were neither slight nor subtle. My bones turned to fire, and my hands crept around his back and slid down. When he tried to draw away, I pulled his hips back toward me. "Not so fast," I thought. His mouth hovered above mine in surprise. My hand slid lower, holding onto his backside possessively, and his breath caught again until it purred in his throat. "Diana," he began, a note of caution in his voice. My kiss demanded he tell me what the problem was.
Matthew's only answer was to move his mouth against mine. He stroked the pulse in my neck, then floated his hand down to cup my left breast, now stroking the fabric over the sensitive skin between my arm and my heart. With his other hand at my waist, he pulled me more tightly against him. After a long while, Matthew loosened his hold enough that he could speak. "You are mine now." My lips were too numb to reply, so I nodded and kept a firm grip on his backside. He stared down at me. "Still no doubts?" "None." "We are one, from this moment forward. Do you understand?"
"I think so."
I understood, at the very least, that no one and nothing was going to keep me from Matthew.
"She has no idea."
Isabeau's voice rang through the courtyard. Matthew stiffened, his arm circling me protectively.
"With that kiss, you have broken every rule that holds our